Little Mary Fagan. She left her home one day. She went to the pencil factory to see the big parade. She left her home at 11. She kissed her mother goodbye. Not one time did the poor child think that she was going to die. Extract from the Ballad of Mary Fagan by Franklin Bliss Snyder.
This show contains descriptions of violent crimes and may not be suitable for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Hello and thank you for joining me for this episode of Prasher's Murder Map. First of all, I'd like to say a huge thank you to all my listeners who have recently been in touch or left reviews. And a big shout out goes to Jean-Claude from Montreal. Your kind words and encouragement really mean a lot to me. Remember to stay tuned to the end, as I'll be playing a promo for duo Emma and Joanna from Scotland, hosts of the Murder She Spoke podcast, so please check out their show. Today we're travelling to Atlanta, Georgia, to investigate a divisive case which deepened the fault lines of racism and anti-Semitism in the state and remains controversial to this day. In March 1913, Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated as the 28th President of the US, and the following year would mark the beginning of the First World War. But the events in Atlanta during 1913 would become a stain in the history books that would not be quickly forgotten, and even today, nobody knows for sure whether justice was really done. The defeat of Confederate troops by Union forces in 1865 led to huge social and political change across the southern states. In Georgia, 29 black representatives and 3 senators were elected in the 1868 elections. But despite their official enfranchisement, virulent racism in society remained. Just 7 years before the case we're about to discuss, newspapers in Atlanta published lurid and unfounded stories about black men sexually assaulting white women, which fanned the flames of an already building fire. A mob of white Atlantans attacked and killed black men, women and children, and targeted their businesses, setting the tone for decades to come. One of Georgia's northerly counties, Forsyth, forced out all of its 1,098 black residents in 1912, 10% of its population, after lynching a black man and 2 black teenage boys, whom the community suspected of murdering an 18-year-old white woman. On top of this, anti-Jewish sentiment and distrust towards northerners was rife. After the Civil War, during the Reconstruction era, many Northerners had travelled south to take advantage of the economic opportunities, bringing with them experience and money, and they became known as carpetbaggers, becoming a source of much resentment. It was against this backdrop of unrest and disunity that one of the most sensational trials in the state's history took place for the brutal murder of teenage factory worker Mary Fagan. It remains Georgia's biggest murder mystery and has attracted more interest over the years than any other murder case in the South. Blue-eyed, auburn-haired Mary Ann Fagan was born in Alabama in 1899 to Father William and Mother Fanny, but tragically, William never lived long enough to meet his daughter as he died of measles a few months before her birth. Shortly afterwards, the family moved to rural Marietta in Georgia, to the northwest of Atlanta. Mary had 2 older brothers and a sister, and was very independent, leaving school aged 10 to work full-time to help support the family, as William's death had left them in a difficult financial situation. Although most southern states at the time had a minimum age of 12 for child labourers, Georgia's standards were the country's worst, with many factories employing children as young as 10. There was little understanding of health and safety, and factory workers suffered from extreme heat in the summer months, cold in the winter, and unsanitary conditions. In 1912, Mary's mother remarried to a man named Jonathan Coleman, and the family moved to a small city apartment in a poor area of Atlanta. The Fagan situation was not uncommon, as there'd been a move away from the agrarian cotton industry, and much like the Industrial Revolution in Britain, people who'd previously lived on rural farms flocked to the cities to find work in mills and factories. By this time, Mary was working at the National Pencil Factory for up to 55 hours a week, operating a machine that fitted erasers into the top of pencils. Somehow, she still managed to find time to enjoy going to the movies with friends. The week of her death, she had only worked two shifts, as a metal shipment had been delayed, slowing down the production schedule. On Saturday, April 26th, 1913, 13-year-old Mary told her family she was going to the factory to collect her paycheck, which was only $1.20, and hoped she would have good news about the shipment and would be needed for more shifts soon. She put on her violet dress and took her silver mesh purse with her, dressed nicely as she planned to enjoy the Confederate Memorial Day parade after she'd collected her pay. She rode the trolley bus into downtown Atlanta and walked towards the four-story building on 37 to 39 South Forsyth Street, where she worked. When she arrived, she went up to the second floor to the office of Superintendent Leo Frank. After this time, none of her friends or family saw Mary alive again. At 3 a.m, night watchman at the pencil factory, Newt Lee, went down to the basement, using his lantern to light the way, and made a disturbing discovery.
Oh my God.
He had stumbled on a body. He immediately called Atlanta police. On Sundays, the electricity at the factory was turned off, so when three police officers arrived on the scene, they couldn't use the elevator, and had to clamber down a ladder through a narrow trapdoor or scuttle hole in the floor to reach the basement where the body lay. Superintendent Leo Frank was the only one with the key to turn on the electricity, and Newt tried to call him, but he wasn't answering his phone. The body lay face down in a pile of debris, completely covered in ash and soot, as though it had been dragged across the basement floor. When police turned the corpse over, they were horrified to see it was a young girl. Her face was badly bruised and scratched. A jagged gash ran along the left side of her head, and one eye was swollen. She had been strangled with a cord. Her dress was pulled up around her waist, and her underwear was torn and bloody, suggesting she had been raped, although medical examiners were never able to officially confirm this. It looked like she'd been dead for several hours. Underneath the body were two cryptic notes, poorly written, with multiple misspellings. They read, "Ma'am, that Negro hired down here did this. I went to make water and he pushed me down that hole. A long, tall Negro black. That who it was. Long, slim, tall Negro. I write while play with me." The next read, "He said he would love me, laid down play like the night witch did it, but that long, tall, black Negro did by himself." Police were immediately suspicious. How could the murdered girl have written the notes while she was being killed? It seemed like an obvious attempt to pin the blame on someone, and by night witch they assumed the writer meant night watchman. After all, Newt Lee was a tall, slim, black man. Although they suspected the real perpetrator had scribbled the barely comprehensible messages to point the finger away from themselves, they arrested Newt for questioning. 16-year-old Grace Hicks, who was a relative of one of the police officers and also worked for the pencil company, was summoned to the mortuary in the hope she might be able to identify the murdered girl. She could. It was Mary Fagan. Police called Superintendent Leo Frank just before 7 a.m. and told him he was wanted at the factory right away. At first, Frank feared there'd been a fire, as this was one of the things he always instructed Newt to be alert for. But when the officer informed him that a tragedy had occurred and a car would be sent to collect him immediately, he realised it was something far more serious. Just a few minutes later, before Frank had even had time to get fully dressed, the car arrived at his home in Georgia Avenue, in Atlanta's German-Jewish district. Leo Frank was a 29-year-old Cornell graduate from Brooklyn who'd studied mechanical engineering and had lived in Georgia for the past 5 years. He was slim and angular, and his round glasses added to his bookish appearance. He was a successful businessman, and his wife Lucille's grandfather was a well-known rabbi, which helped bolster his status further in the Jewish community. Lucille's parents lived at Georgia Avenue with them. Detective Black, assigned to the case in the early hours of the morning, noticed that Frank seemed nervous and agitated when they knocked on his door to drive him to the factory. When asked if he knew Mary Fagan, Frank said no, but when reminded about a young girl coming to his office to collect her pay, he admitted that yes, a girl had come the day before, but he didn't know her by name. After all, there were many young women working for him, and she requested her pay envelope by giving her employee number. At the mortuary, Frank seemed distressed at the sight of the body and had to be encouraged to take a closer look. He admitted she was the girl who'd come for her wages, and he continued to fidget anxiously throughout the identification. Was this an understandable reaction from a man who'd been informed of the heartbreaking murder at the factory he managed, or did his demeanour indicate something more? News spread like wildfire, and a crowd was gathered outside the factory by the time Detective Black and Leo Frank arrived at 7:45 a.m. Frank opened the safe and checked the ledgers to confirm that yes, it was Mary Fagan who'd come for her wages just after 12 o'clock the day before. He was sure she had left straight away after receiving her $1.20. He also checked Newt Lee's time card and confirmed he'd punched in every 30 minutes, exactly as he should have, during his shift between 6 p.m. and 3 a.m. Next, Frank turned on the electricity so they could go to the basement in the elevator, rather than down the ladder and through the trapdoor. Detective Black noticed Frank seemed too nervous even to get the elevator moving and offered to help. As the elevator hit the basement floor, everyone noticed a horrible smell. It turned out that a pile of human excrement had been left in the shaft. When the elevator touched down, it smashed into the offensive heap, releasing an unmistakable stench of feces. Believe it or not, this would later turn out to be a pivotal point in the case. The second search of the basement turned up nothing new, and Frank was asked to go to the police station to read the notes that had been found under Mary's body. But incredibly, when they got there, they found the notes had been borrowed by a reporter from the Atlanta Journal, who published them the next day. They hadn't even been checked for fingerprints, yet someone had handed them over to the press. Leo Frank was told to go home. Later that day, former streetcar conductor Arthur Mullinax was arrested based on a rumour that he knew the victim, but this proved to be unfounded and he was released without charge. The public was up in arms about the killing and angrily demanded justice. One newspaper printed the mortuary photo on their front page in a deliberate attempt to shock, and parents were sickened and afraid. Many families had no choice but to send their children to work in factories to earn enough to survive, and these could be dangerous jobs at the best of times. Now, It was a terrifying prospect. The next day, on April 28th, former bookkeeper at the company, James Gant, who was known to have been infatuated with Mary, was arrested. He turned up at the office on the day of the murder to collect some shoes he'd left behind when he was sacked 2 weeks previously. Leo Frank instructed Newt Lee to let him in to get his shoes, see him out, then lock the door after him. Like Mullinax, Gant was soon cleared of any suspicion. The same day, new evidence emerged. A red stain on the floor of the metal department was found, close to Mary's workstation, later proven to be blood, and about a dozen strands of hair were found on a lathe, matching Mary's hair colour. Machinist R.P. Barrett, who made the discoveries, said it looked as though someone had tried to sweep away and whitewash the bloodstains. The cleaner was certain they hadn't been there on Friday. It now looked like Mary hadn't been killed in the basement, but on the second floor in the metal department, on the same floor as Leo Frank's office. At this point, Newt Lee was still being questioned by Detective Black and Chief of Detectives Newport Langford. Newt explained he'd been asked to arrive at 4 p.m. on Saturday for his shift as night watchman, earlier than usual, as Frank intended to leave early to go to the ball game. But when Newt arrived, Frank told him apologetically that he'd changed his mind and needed to finish up some work, so he wasn't going to the game after all. He told Newt to go and enjoy the parade and come back later at 6, even though Newt suggested he could stay in the shipping room and get some sleep instead. He was tired, so he might have preferred this option, but Frank was insistent on his leaving and returning later. Newt said his employer seemed nervous and was rubbing his hands, something he'd never seen him do before, although he'd only been working there for about 3 weeks. Around 7 p.m, Newt received a call from Frank to check everything was all right, which was also unusual, as he'd never done this before either. Frank was summoned to the police station again, and on arrival, he told them he'd looked at Newt's punch card again, and that he'd missed several check-ins on the night of the murder. But he'd looked at it the day before in front of the police and said everything was in order, so they were immediately suspicious that he was intentionally casting aspersions on his night watchman. By now, Frank's boss had realised his superintendent was quickly becoming a suspect and arranged for hotshot attorney Luther Rosser to represent him. Rosser was as tenacious as a bulldog and very expensive. When he arrived at the police station, he was quick to point out that his client had no cuts or scratches on him, and Frank even invited detectives to his home to show them his dirty laundry. There was no blood or soot on any of his clothes. Nonetheless, he must have been concerned that even Rosser wouldn't be able to extricate him from the situation, because the pencil company contacted the Pinkertons' Atlanta office, who didn't come cheap, and hired Detective Harry Scott to investigate. Frank told him all about the members of staff at the factory he considered suspicious, and a rumour he had heard that Mrs. White, the wife of one of the employees, who'd visited her husband at work on April 26th, had noticed a black man wearing blue clothing lurking near the elevator shaft around the time of Mary's death. Things started looking worse for Frank when employee Montine Stover claimed she'd visited his office to collect her pay at about 10 past 12 on the day of the murder, but he wasn't there, so she left. She also noticed the door of the metal room was closed. Could the reason he hadn't been in his office be that he was in the metal room attacking Mary Fagan? By now, the Atlanta, Georgia newspaper was offering a $500 reward, which would soon increase to a huge $1,000, and police were struggling to hold back more than 10,000 people who turned up at the mortuary to view the body. Meanwhile, a blood-soaked shirt was discovered in a barrel in night watchman Newt Lee's yard. Given the inherent culture of racism at the time, it's testament to the detectives working the case that they didn't automatically assume he was guilty. Detective Black noticed the shirt looked freshly pressed and unworn, and the red stains were so thick they looked as though they'd been applied intentionally. Added to the notes found under Mary's body about the night witch, it certainly appeared that someone had set out to railroad Newt. On Tuesday, April 29th, Leo Frank received an unwelcome visit at the pencil factory from Detective Black and Pinkerton Detective Harry Scott. Much to Frank's shock, Scott had come to the same conclusion as Black. They believed Leo Frank was Mary Fagan's killer. He was questioned relentlessly, but steadfastly declared his innocence. He repeated that he was a God-fearing man, a respectable man, a married man, but his words didn't convince detectives. Hoping to learn something more, they put him in a room with Newt Lee, both suspects handcuffed to their chairs, and left the room, listening intently from outside. Frank urged Newt to tell the truth, and Newt replied, "Before God, I am telling the truth. I've told them all I know." Throughout, the night watchman stuck to his story, while Frank stuck to his pleas of innocence. The inquest began the next day, and a troubling story emerged. 14-year-old newsboy George Epps testified that he had ridden in the trolley with Mary on the day of her death. She told him she was on her way to the pencil factory to pick up her pay, but agreed to meet him afterwards at the parade and to go and see a movie later. He believed Mary feared Frank and didn't like the way he looked at her, as he would wink and smile inappropriately. She often wanted George to come and escort her home when her shift was over, and he desperately regretted not going with her that Saturday, as he had to finish selling papers before the parade started. Leo Frank remained in custody. Soon, another suspect appeared. On May 1st, the day after Epps' testimony, day watchman Mr. Holloway spotted Black janitor Jim Connolly washing a blue shirt in the shipping room and got the impression that he was trying to hide it from him. He contacted police and Connolly was arrested, something not unfamiliar to him, as he had a lengthy rap sheet which included disorderly conduct and attempted armed robbery. By now, factory employee Julia Fuss had also become suspicious of Connolly, as she had noticed him grinning as he read newspaper articles about the case. She stated she didn't trust him, but she also referred to him using the N-word, so we have to remember that her prejudices might have played a part in her perceptions. At first, police were sceptical that Connolly could have had anything to do with the murder, and he claimed to be illiterate, so he couldn't have written the notes. But when Frank told them he could write and frequently took inventory for him, and they realised he'd been observed reading newspapers, detectives started to view him in a different light. Connolly was confronted about his lie and eventually admitted to being able to write. He was asked to copy sentences from the two notes found under Mary's body, and the writing matched, with the same misspellings and errors. It took a week in solitary confinement in the basement of the police station to make him speak. Connolly admitted to writing the letters, but not to committing the murder. His story was sensational. He claimed Leo Frank had paid him to watch the door while he assaulted Mary, and asked him to help hide the evidence. They carried her lifeless body down to the basement in the elevator, and Frank forced Connolly to write the messages to frame Newt Lee for the murder. I find it interesting that once again, police believed a black man, and this seems unusual for Georgia in this time period. Some have suggested they were even more prejudiced against Jews and Northerners than they were against black people, and Jim Connolly was an Atlantan born and bred, while college graduate Leo Frank was a symbol of the northern industrialization they resented. Did this case have a hope of being tried fairly in a state tainted not only by racism, but anti-Semitism and anti-Northern sentiment. I'll talk about this a bit more later, and the answer may not be what you'd expect. Either way, Frank quickly became a monster in the eyes of the public. As far as many people were concerned, he was guilty until proven innocent, not the other way around. Some of the less reputable newspapers spewed vitriol and drummed up outrage until the public were baying for blood. The trial began on July 28, 1913, in Atlanta's City Hall. Hugh Dorsey and his team for the prosecution and Lou Ferrosa and his team for the defence battled it out under the eagle eye of presiding judge Leonard Roan. Mary's mother Fanny was unable to hold back floods of tears when the jury was shown her daughter's violet dress and silver mesh purse that she had worn so proudly on April 26th. She described her daughter as sensible, pretty, in good humour and trustworthy, as she remembered how she looked so beautiful, young and bright the last time she saw her. Everyone in the courtroom was moved by her display of emotion, except Leo Frank, who remained stony-faced. Newt Lee repeated his testimony about Frank's behaviour on the day of the murder, and Detective Black told the court he had noticed how nervous Frank seemed when requested to view the body and accompany the detectives to the factory basement. Janitor Jim Connolly's testimony was show-stopping. He repeated his story that he'd been guarding the front door while his employer was with Mary upstairs, something he alleged he'd been asked to do on many other Saturdays. He said that when Frank whistled as a signal for him to unlock the door, he noticed his boss acting strangely, rubbing his hands together in agitation and holding a long, wide piece of cord. Connolly maintained that Frank said, "I wanted to be with the little girl, and she refused me. I struck her, and I guess I struck her too hard, and she fell and hit her head." He was then enlisted to help hide the body. When asked why he didn't refuse to help or go to the police straight away, Connolly said that as Frank was a white man and his boss, he felt he had to do what he was told. Plus, he'd been promised $200 to keep quiet. He reported that Frank said, "Why should I hang? I have wealthy people in Brooklyn." Frank's defense lawyer, Rosser, rigorously cross-examined Connolly for somewhere between 8 and 11 hours, questioning why he had produced four different affidavits. There were many inconsistencies in his stories, and he'd already been caught out in a lie about being illiterate. Connolly claimed he couldn't remember his initial statement and admitted he'd lied, but no matter how hard Rosser tried, he couldn't break Connolly's final story, the version of events where Frank killed Mary Fagan and asked him to help hide the body and write the notes. Everyone watching the tiring barrage of questions and answers seemed to accept that even though he'd lied at the beginning, Connolly was telling the truth now. He also admitted the human excrement found in the elevator shaft was his. Some sources say that when Connolly finished his testimony, spectators clapped and cheered, but looking at primary sources such as the court transcript and newspaper articles from the time, there's no proof this ever happened. It may have been invented afterwards to make people believe that the trial was biased from the outset, and that feeling in the courtroom was pro-Connolly and anti-Frank. The case wore on for another 3 weeks, and each time Dorsey put forward evidence implicating Leo Frank, Rosser would rebut it with an alternative explanation. One thing the defence couldn't rebut was a slew of statements from girls who worked in the factory, all stating under oath that Frank was of bad character, frequently flirting with them and peering into their changing room with no good reason. Rosser and his team chose not to cross-examine these witnesses, perhaps concerned that their stories were indeed true, although they did manage to produce some other female employees who claimed no knowledge of any inappropriate behaviour from Frank. Even if he was a pervert, it didn't necessarily make him a killer, but back in those days, with little physical evidence to go on, character witnesses were fundamental to a jury's decision. It seemed clear that either Frank or Connolly, or both together, were involved in Mary Fagan's death. It didn't make sense that anyone from outside the factory would have followed her inside and killed her, and nobody external would have been familiar enough with the layout and the basement to hide her body there. Partially digested food in Mary's stomach put her time of death around 12, the time she'd visited Frank's office. The defence team's theory was that Connolly, an inveterate drunk and gambler, planned to rob one of the girls who came that day to collect their pay. He could have hit her on the head as she was on her way out of the building, carried her down to the basement and strangled her there, before writing the notes, pointing the finger at fellow employee Newt Lee and stealing her money. It did seem strange that college-educated Frank would have come up with the idea to write the notes, as it was immediately obvious to police that Mary couldn't possibly have written them while being murdered. Could Connolly have been the killer all along, completely fabricating Frank's involvement? Then again, why did Frank continue to employ a man like Connolly for 2 years, who had been drunk at work on numerous occasions, apparently urinated on the pencils, and was earning significantly more in his role than any of the more experienced workers, even though as a black man in the lowly job of sweeper or janitor, he was at the bottom of the pile? Maybe he was useful to Frank and he kept him on with the specific object of doing his dirty work and watching the door while he entertained young girls. When Frank finally took the witness stand, he spoke for 4 hours in an eloquent and calm manner, which was at odds with his apparent nervousness on the day of and day after the murder. He told the court about his life since his birth in Texas, his experiences of college, his trip to Europe to study the manufacture of pencils before taking the job at the company, and the happiness he had experienced since his marriage. He claimed that despite public opinion, he wasn't from a rich family and had no wealthy relatives in Brooklyn. Instead, his father was an invalid, and the only way his defense could be paid for was through his parents selling a portion of their estate. He then showed his weekly financial sheet to the jury, explaining the figures and calculations in excruciating detail. This is what he had been working on the afternoon of Mary's death, and was part of his circumstantial alibi. How could a man with blood on his hands sit down and accurately complete his accounts immediately afterwards? His version of the events of April 26th include interactions with many other people who had been at the factory that day. These included stenographer Miss Hall, who came to help him with some typing and left about 12, just 10 minutes or so before Mary arrived. Two fathers who came to collect their son's pay because the boys were in trouble with the police and couldn't come themselves, and someone who wanted to ask permission to use the telephone. Just 5 minutes after Mary collected her pay, Lemmy Quinn, foreman of the plant, entered Frank's office and spoke to him. Frank carried on working until 12:45, when he phoned his wife to check what time he should go home for lunch. Before leaving, he went up to the fourth floor and spoke to two male employees, White and Denham, as well as Mrs. White, who'd come to visit her husband at work. Frank told them he was leaving for lunch and would lock the factory door on his way out, so Mrs. White decided to go as well rather than be locked in. When Frank returned, he unlocked all the doors, told the men upstairs he'd returned, and then went back to his office to complete his accounts. Just before White and Denham left for the day, White went to see Frank to request a $2 advance on his wages, which was granted. Just before 6 p.m, Newt Lee returned to start his night shift, after being told earlier to go and enjoy the parade. When Frank left the office, he posted two letters, one of which was to his uncle, and whose wording showed no sign of agitation. He got himself a drink at a soda fountain, and bought a box of candy for his wife, boarded a streetcar, and arrived home at 6:25 p.m, where he enjoyed a normal evening. He explained to the court why he'd been so anxious when Detective Black knocked on his door in the early hours of April 27th. he said.
Gentlemen, I was nervous. I was completely unstrung. Imagine, awakened out of my sound sleep, and a morning run in an automobile driven at top speed, without any breakfast, rushing into a dark passageway, coming into a darkened room, and then suddenly an electric light flashed on, and to see the sight that was presented by that poor little child? Why, it was a sight that was enough to drive a man to distraction. A sight that would have made a stone melt. I had no part in causing the death of little Mary Fagin, nor do I know how she came to her death after she took her money and left my office. I never saw Connolly in the factory on that date, April 26th, 1913. Connolly's statement is a tissue of lies from first to last.
His statement was strong and moving, to the point that the court remained in stunned silence for almost 10 seconds after he finished speaking. One thing was missing though. As far as I can tell, he made no mention of how sad he was about Mary's death and offered no commiserations to her family. You might have expected a good employer to at least visit the family home or offer a gift, even financial support for the funeral, but I could see no evidence that this ever happened. On August 25th, less than 4 hours after the jury began deliberations, the verdict was returned. Leo Frank's articulate address had been useless. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. The atmosphere on the streets was a triumphant celebration. The verdict was what the public wanted. Frank's defense team immediately embarked on preparations for a lengthy appeals process. I found a mine of information in a book written in 1913 but published anonymously called The Frank Case, Inside Story of George's Greatest Mystery. This is available online both as text and an audiobook, and I'll put the link in the show notes. This is a very important source because it's full of detail that could only have been obtained by someone who was in the courtroom hearing a blow-by-blow account of the proceedings, and as it was published contemporaneously, I've taken it to be reliable. According to the book, and contrary to what you might assume, the trial was conducted as fairly as possible. The idea of Frank being treated badly because he was Jewish was brought up by the defence, and until that time, nobody had mentioned his Jewishness in any context. Conversely, the N-word was used frequently by witnesses in relation to the black employees of the pencil company, showing that if anything, there was far more risk of a black man like Jim Connolly being found guilty of a crime he didn't commit than of Leo Frank. Let's not forget that segregation was in effect at this time, and black employees at the factory had to use a toilet in the basement, separate from the white employees. Jim Crow laws would stay in force until the 1960s. Adolf Ox, owner of the New York Times, along with other prominent Jewish businessmen, rallied round to launch a public campaign to clear Frank's name. For the rest of the year, the New York Times published article after article on the case and the trial, and in the North, many people believed in Frank's innocence and sent letters of support and donations. Their views, however, were at odds with those of the people of Georgia, and the campaign was seen as yet more evidence of Northern interference in Southern affairs. In an incredibly irresponsible, provocative move, Thomas E. Watson, an attorney with his eyes on future presidency, wrote boldly anti-Semitic articles in his newspaper, The Jeffersonian, cursing the New York Times campaign, saying it was a conspiracy by rich Jews. When the execution kept being postponed, and there was concern that the death sentence might be commuted, he overtly encouraged vigilantism, saying that mob justice was better than none at all. By April 1915, 2 years after the murder, Frank was still in prison after numerous requests for a retrial. But when the Supreme Court overturned the final appeal, the execution looked set to go ahead with no hope of a reprieve. But when a posthumous letter emerged from Judge Roan urging Governor Slayton to consider commuting the sentence to life imprisonment and admitting his uncertainty over Frank's guilt, the governor had no choice but to review the case. He was due to leave office soon and had hoped to leave this thorny issue to his successor, but rather than passing the buck, he dutifully looked at the evidence. Despite colleagues and the public urging, and indeed threatening him to uphold the death penalty, he was thorough in his final hearing and willingly put his reputation on the line to ensure justice was done. The final hearing started on June 12th, just 10 days before the execution date, and Slayton focused on areas that had been overlooked in the trial. You might remember the human feces in the lift shaft. This unlikely piece of evidence became key in the decision that Slayton would make. When the electricity was first turned on Sunday 27th of April, the day after the murder, the police officers went down in the elevator with Leo Frank and noticed a stench. This had been caused by the bottom of the elevator smashing down into the human stalls, releasing the putrid odour. Governor Slayton visited the basement and inspected the elevator, riding it up and down and testing to see if it was possible to stop it early. It wasn't. If you used the elevator, it would always touch down on the ground, thereby squashing the excrement. This contradicted Jim Connolly's statement that after the murder, he and Frank had used the elevator to transport Mary's body down to the basement. If they had, they would already have hit the pile of fecal matter, but it clearly happened for the first time much later when the police arrived. In the 1988 TV miniseries about the case, this is dramatised more politely using an umbrella, but the concept still stands. Connolly's story didn't add up, and as far as Slayton was concerned, if Connolly had lied about that, then maybe other parts of his testimony were untrue as well. The governor made the agonising decision to commute the sentence to life imprisonment, although some have argued that it wasn't such an agonising decision after all, as it was Slayton's own law firm which was running Frank's defence. Knowing that Frank's life would be in danger, given the public mood, Governor Slayton arranged for the prisoner to be moved in the middle of the night to a secure penitentiary in Milledgeville, just a day before his execution was due, and released a 20-page statement explaining his decision. In response, his home was visited by a mob and became the scene of a huge brawl. Elsewhere, another mob burned an effigy of him, calling him the traitor governor of Georgia and even king of the Jews. At the inauguration ceremony for his successor, a spectator ran at Slayton brandishing a lead pipe, but a member of the National Guard managed to deflect it. Slayton and his wife rapidly left for New York City, their lives intact but their nerves and his political career in tatters. This case is a tricky and divisive one. I always try to come to my own conclusions in every episode, but with this one I found it difficult. It's hard to understand how either Frank or Connolly could have committed the murder in the pencil factory and disposed of Mary Fagan's body in the basement without anyone noticing. It's clear that Connolly was involved, as he admitted to writing the notes, but whether he acted alone or whether his story about Leo Frank is true is a question I struggle to unravel. If Frank's story was true about having spoken to Lemmy Quinn just a few minutes after Mary collected her pay at around 12:15, then it would be unlikely he could have killed her, arranged for Connolly to remove the body, then been back in time to speak to Quinn. But this has been questioned and is unclear whether it really happened. Frank only came up with this alibi later and didn't tell police when first questioned, and if it could have been easily proven in court, then surely the defence would have been all over it, using it to their advantage. Even without Quinn though, the timing would have been tight for Frank to commit murder and go up to his employees on the fourth floor about 45 minutes later to tell them he was going home for lunch without appearing ruffled in any way. At first, I imagined the factory as being all but empty on a Saturday. But as I read more about the case, I learned this was far from true, and a murderer would be at significant risk of being seen. This would suggest a crime of passion rather than of premeditation, and with the evidence from the girls working there about Frank's lewd behaviour, it does look like he could be guilty, maybe trying to sexually assault Mary, and things got out of hand. I think it's likely he was involved, but there is room for reasonable doubt. From a legal standpoint, Conley was the only one with a direct link to the crime, as he had admitted to writing the notes, yet he was sentenced to just 1 year in a chain gang for accessory to murder. Despite a lack of evidence in Frank's case, he was found guilty and sentenced to die. When the public heard about the commutation to life imprisonment, the bubbling fury that had been building up throughout the trial finally erupted. They weren't willing to let go of their desire for vengeance. And I use the word vengeance, not justice, because vigilantism isn't about justice at all. A necktie party was formed, determined to carry out the sentence they felt should have been upheld. Guilty or innocent, mob violence is never acceptable. Anyone who's seen the Henry Fonda film, The Oxbow Incident, will know what I mean. Clearly this spitting, chanting, angry swathe of humanity wasn't interested in the chance that Frank could be innocent and just wanted to see him swing. Had the suspect on trial been a non-Jew, I strongly believe they would have done the same thing. It was less about anti-Semitism, although it did exist, and more about a desperation to exact revenge for the tragic, heartbreaking loss of a young girl. Frank's fellow inmates at Milledgeville got wind of a rumour that a mob planned to shoot indiscriminately through the windows of the prison in hope of hitting Frank, so someone decided to slash his throat before they had the chance. But a prison doctor saved his life. Less than a month later, on August 16, 1915, seven cars carrying 25 masked, armed men pulled up outside the prison at 10 p.m. They called themselves the Knights of Mary Fagan and cut the phone lines to delay discovery, forcing the guards at gunpoint to open the gates and burst into Frank's cell. Within 10 minutes they bundled him into a car and were on their way to Woodlands in rural Marietta, not far from where Mary grew up. They looped a rope from a branch of an ash tree and made Frank stand on a table as they tightened it around his neck. When asked if he had any last words, he repeated that he was innocent. The table was kicked from under him, and he struggled for several minutes, the wound on his neck reopening painfully before he eventually died. The worst part of this atrocity is that hundreds of people drove to Marietta to revel at the sight of the hanging, even taking photos of the morbid scene, attacking Frank's dead body, and removing artifacts as souvenirs, including, weirdly, his clothes. One of the photos even ended up on a famous postcard, which can be seen on the internet today. French poet Rémy de Gourmont put it beautifully when he said, "It is obvious that those who are in favour of the death penalty have more affinities with murderers than those who oppose it." Irrespective of whether Leo Frank was guilty or innocent, the desire to flock to the scene and revel in the death of a human being speaks more about the spectators than it does about him, and what he might or might not have done. However jubilant it made them feel, it didn't bring Mary back. None of the lynch mob were ever charged for their actions that night. 3 months later, some of the men who had been involved reignited the Ku Klux Klan, soon to move on to committing acts of hatred and violence against black people once again. Although anti-Semitism might have not been a major factor in the courtroom proceedings, it certainly arose after Frank's guilty verdict and the lynching, with over 1,000 Jewish families leaving the area in fears for their safety. September 1913 had also seen the birth of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, a Jewish NGO with the motto, "Fighting Hate for Good." Georgia wasn't the only place where racist violence occurred. For example, in 1920 in Minnesota, three black men were lynched following an alleged sexual assault of a white woman. The mob responsible posed for photos with the bodies as they smiled for the camera, proud of their outrageous act. They behaved as if murdering three people was the greatest achievement of their lives, a story which they no doubt told their children and grandchildren, recounting the day they made a mockery of justice, a word which to them was synonymous with revenge. In 1982, former employee of the pencil factory, Alonzo Mann, who had worked as an office boy for Leo Frank, came forward on his deathbed to tell an eyebrow-raising story. He produced a sworn affidavit that he'd seen Jim Connolly carrying Mary's body near the trapdoor to the basement. He swore that Connolly said to him,
"If you tell anyone about this, I will kill you."
Alonzo's mother also warned him not to get involved, no doubt worried about the mob turning on them next for any attempt to exonerate the Jewish superintendent. He also stated he'd never witnessed anything bad about Frank's character, but he'd only been working at the pencil company for a few weeks and didn't even know Mary Fagan. He could have come forward in 1962 after Connolly's death, as there would have been nothing left to fear, but instead he waited another 20 years. Why? Mann's confession, if it's to be believed, would still be consistent with two different interpretations. It could mean that Connolly acted alone, or it could mean that Connolly's story was true, and Frank murdered Mary, and then got Connolly to dispose of the body. Either way, it looks like we'll never know. Mary Fagan was buried in the southeast corner of the Marietta City Cemetery. A posthumous pardon was eventually offered to Frank for failing to keep him safe in custody, although it didn't officially declare him innocent of the crime. His body was returned to his wife Lucille, and he was buried in Brooklyn. Public opinion is still split, but it's worth noting that some members of the Fagan family still believe Leo Frank was the killer. But no matter who murdered Mary, her bereaved family had to live with her absence forever, adjusting to the hole in their life that was once filled by their vibrant, happy, independent daughter, who worked so hard day after day to help support the household financially, a burden that no one so young should ever have to bear. Thank you for listening to Prash's Murder Map. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. I'd love to hear from you with any comments or suggestions, so get in touch via Twitter at Prash's Murder Map, visit www.prashesmurdermap.com, or simply do things the old-fashioned way and email me at prashesmurdermap@gmail.com. I'm completely independent and create this podcast in a spare bedroom in my home. I love making the show, but it's costly to produce, so any support you can give me via Patreon or a one-off donation via PayPal will help me continue to create high-quality episodes. The links are in the show notes. Thanks everyone for your support. Next time I'm going to do something a bit different. As lots of you have sent questions in for me, I thought it would be fun to do a Q&A session. In that episode, I'll also be announcing an exciting, immersive, 7-part mini-series coming in November, and you might just get a sneak preview of what's coming. Until then, take care, everyone.
I'm Joanna.
I'm Emma.
We're the hosts of Murder, She Spoke, a true crime podcast focusing on Scottish crimes and disappearances. The more obscure, the better.
If you enjoy hearing about lesser-known crimes, both solved and unsolved, join us as we share victim stories and try to shine some light on the darkness.
While we take the cases seriously, we don't take ourselves seriously, and we always end with a funny true crime fact.
You can find Murder, She Spoke on your favourite podcast platforms on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram.